Chris Raunchy, Amy Martzgores, because life is too short for boring radio. 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Chris and Amy show on KMOX, and John Hancock is in today. It's good to have you along for the ride. We are talking to Dave Simons, who is a partner and managing director of One Private Wealth. Dave, good to have you with us. How are you?
Thanks, Chris. Good to be here as always. Hello, John.
Hey, buddy. Good to always love this segment every week.
Yeah, love talking to you. I have no idea what you're going to be watching tonight. Maybe a rerun or something. I can't imagine.
Oh, Billikens basketball, buddy.
All right.
Billikens and Dayton. Are you kidding me?
Oh, I totally forgot about that. That's much more enjoyable than a certain show on tonight. Yes.
So let's talk about that State of the Union, because I did want to ask you about the tariffs, which some are apparently going into place on imports. And this was even after the Supreme Court struck down, you know, his unilateral tariffs. And I think there's so much confusion here because people don't know what this means. Is he still trying to implement them, even though the Supreme Court said he can't? So with that confusion comes uncertainty. And with that, it messes with the markets. So where do we stand today?
Yeah, Chris, you actually nailed the word, and that is uncertainty. Wall Street hates uncertainty. It typically sells first, asks questions later until it can eliminate some of that uncertainty. It's the old cliche of the devil you know versus the devil you don't. And the market spent all of last year in 2025 trying to figure out what the tariffs were going to do, what industries were going to get hit, what countries will be affected. Oh, this industry is getting a certain carve out. Oh, that company has got a little special tariff just for them. And after a while, the market kind of settled in and go, okay, we may not like this. It's a little chaotic, but at least we sort of have a game plan. Well, the Supreme Court decision, which was not a surprise at all to Wall Street, really throws that all out the window. It's like, okay, man, here we go again. And it's more confusing than ever. So no real surprise. The market has sold off a little bit. I'm not bearish. I don't think that one decision is going to cause any real damage to the market. In fact, it's nicely up today. But it does bring on some uncertainty. And I don't think you can get a resumption of the bull market until we get more clarity.
Yeah. And, you know, the president has now chosen a different statute under which to impose sweeping tariffs. And yep. You know, that's going to be, you know, adjudicated, although this one has some kind of a fairly short window of effectiveness, right? Am I reading that right?
Yep. Section 122 of an old trade act in 1974 that has not been enacted in decades. I mean, I guess they took the cobwebs out, and I think they knew, the Trump administration knew, that the decision was probably going to go against them because, man, they just brought all of this out immediately. And that Section 122 says that a president can impose tariffs of up to 10% across the board. And the quote is this: to deal with large and serious United States balance of payment deficits. Very antiquated. That was back when we were still on the gold standard. So he's got 150 days to figure this out. And they're throwing out all of these other sections, 201, 301, 232. And that's why the market is just like, we don't know what this is going to do. And by the way, on the tariffs that have been really rendered null and void in the past, all these companies now are wondering, should we sue the government? Should we try to get this money back? We're already seeing that. How about us as consumers? All studies have shown that
we've paid
some of this. Mm-hmm. Do we all get a check for a couple grand in the mail? I mean, it's probably not, but it just belies the point again about the chaos that has ensued because of this. Things will settle down, but until then, expect more volatility.
You mentioned balance of payments. That's essentially the difference between what we import versus what we export to other countries. Economists generally, I think, believe that that's not really that important of a figure. Is that right?
John, thank you for asking that question, because I was just talking to somebody else about that this morning. Every white paper that's been written, every study that has been conducted on this comes to the same conclusion. When you are king of the land economically around the world, which we have been post-World War II, you are typically going to run a deficit. And that has only increased as the global economy has become more flatlined. We have, Americans do, this insatiable appetite to consume. And that is what has driven this economy for decades. It's what's actually, frankly, driven the global economy for decades. Well, we as a country cannot, it's impossible to produce everything that we want to buy. So all this talk about, well, then let's pull all the manufacturing back here. Okay, sounds great in theory, but expect prices to be paid to double and triple and quadruple because we're going to pay them American wages as opposed to a lot of these foreign countries. So you cannot have your cake and eat it too. Running deficits is actually a sign of strength in this global economy. So I don't fully understand this desire to try to even the playing field. I get it if you feel that a country is taking advantage of it, so you can piecemeal this. And that's why I think the market was expecting that a year ago. But this across the board, everybody gets 10 to 15%, to me is not workable, and it's unnecessary.
Is it possible? Okay, so let's talk about what is a... I guess an acceptable level of deficit, because if you have too much of it, right, then you're talking about a real issue. But is there an acceptable level that we want to be at? And can you know what that is? You know what I mean? Like, there's not a number, right?
Yeah, Chris, I think if I remember right, the historical average in this country is a deficit that's about 70 or 80% of GDP. Japan has run a deficit for years of over 200% GDP, their deficit. And that's why that economy has flatlined for over 30 years. It's only now starting to improve because they're attacking it. So yeah, we are slightly over 100%, that's historically high. It has not mattered yet, but it will at some point, because I've said this before, the bond vigilantes, man, that is the most powerful group in finance anywhere in the world. And people who buy our bonds around the world, all institutions, individuals, pension plans, if they decide that our deficit is too high and it can prove to be inflationary and hurt the dollar, they will start selling our bonds. What is that tipping point? I don't know. Is it 120% GDP? Is it 150? It's out there, and we are incrementally still moving in that direction. I have longer term concerns, nothing today yet.
Yeah, and you look at the national debt and financing our national debt, which is now 30 whatever trillion.
Approaching 40 now. Yeah. We're right on the edge of 40 trillion.
And our countries, at some point, do folks stop financing our debt? And then what do we do?
That's exactly right. That's my concern. If you have, well, you had, what was it, a couple of months ago when Sweden decided, hey, we don't want to own U.S. debt anymore. We don't really like what's happening politically. We don't like all this talk about coming into one of our neighbors and taking over Greenland. We don't really know if we can trust what the U.S. is doing. I'm not making a personal political statement. I'm just rehashing what Sweden has said, and they don't want to be part of this. So they have ordered their government pension plans to sell their U.S. treasuries because they don't know if the dollar is going to stay strengthened through all of this. So it is a problem longer term. I've been really amazed at how well it has held up. The dollar has weakened a little bit. It was overvalued, in my opinion, so I welcome this. But if it continues to weaken against other currencies, then you could have some issues. You could have an inflationary problem. And therein lies, guys, why gold is back to hitting all-time records. More investors are, including big governments around the world, who feel, I don't know if we can count on the U.S. having the big dollar anymore to kind of support the global economy. So we're going to start hedging, and we're going to be buying more gold, silver, and other commodities.
So Meta has a new deal for GPUs, for artificial intelligence. What does that mean for AI stocks?
Oh, my goodness. AI stocks have actually been, believe it or not, this is not getting as much headlines as I thought. But if you go back a year when AI stocks were peaking, about April, somewhere in there of a year ago, they've actually been underperforming the rest of the market. It's interesting what analysts are calling this. The real economy is back. What does that mean? It's the old-fashioned economy. You're seeing industrial companies. You're seeing retailers. You're seeing certain selected healthcare stocks. Even some of the old line tech stocks have done a little bit better. The AI stocks like NVIDIA, like Broadcom and others, Microsoft, are all down. And in some cases, double digits. And I think what it is because people are finally getting concerned about all the spending, hundreds of billions of dollars, Meta being one of them, and to try to make sure that they are in front of the race, the AI race, as they build out the thumbprint, all the data centers that are being built. And now investors, especially the big institutional guys, are going, okay, when are you going to be done spending all your profit and actually show some return on AI, because it hasn't happened? So I think longer term on that, Chris, AI stocks, yes, you got to have some exposure there depending on your risk tolerance. But here in the near term, I suspect that the old economy stocks will continue to outperform.
Looking at the global economy and foreign stock markets, are we seeing any trends globally about where the economy is heading?
Absolutely, 100%. So starting about a year ago on that, John, international and foreign stocks, as on average, have outperformed U.S. stocks. We've been waiting for that for honestly about 15 years. We get little stops and starts. International will do a little bit better for 6 months, 9 months, and then the U.S. takes over. And for obvious reasons, this has been going on since the end of the Great Recession 15, 16 years ago. But international stocks got so cheap. And sort of a side domino that has come from the way Trump has managed kind of some of the global relations is that these foreign companies now are spending more money internally, especially on defense, on their defense, because Trump, and I agree with him on this, he'll look to a lot of these NATO countries and say, look, guys, we kind of fund most of this. And I think you're just sort of getting a little bit of a free ride here because you know that the U.S. is going to come to your defense and they'll finance it too. Well, I'm sorry, those freebie days are over. And so a lot of these European countries are saying, oh, geez, okay, we better increase our own defense and reach deals with other countries. That may hurt us longer term here in the U.S., but if you're an investor, and that's what I always like to get back down to, and you have not increased your international stock exposure, now it's not too late. We think this thing has legs. We have been increasing our international exposure in our model since last year and continue to do so.
So Bitcoin is on the verge of some sort of, I don't know, I've seen people call it a collapse, but there's a little bit less confidence in it at the moment. It's just that it's a very volatile thing to get into, and I still don't quite understand the appeal of it. And I feel like a lot of people are probably setting themselves up for massive disappointment down the road. But where do you stand on it?
Chris, I've never really been able to get my arms around the concept of Bitcoin. I get it with blockchain technology, but everything that the Bitcoin bulls tried to sell us on in the early days has turned out not to be true. Well, it's going to be a hedge against inflation. Nope, it didn't do that. Well, it's going to be an alternative to gold. Nope, hasn't held up with that. It basically trades like a high-flying tech stock. And it could it be 200,000 someday? Okay, sure. Could it go to 10,000? Mm-hmm, yeah, sure. I mean, so you can tell I'm pretty agnostic on it. We do not own any Bitcoin in any of our portfolios. And any clients who have expressed interest, I just politely say, if you want to do that on your own, but we just feel that there are, let's just be serious investors here. If anyone wants to play on it, I have no problem with it. But I tell them it's just kind of gambling. And my viewpoint has been proven accurate once again as this thing has been cut in half.
Dave Simons, always appreciate our conversations. We'll talk again next week.
Okay. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, John. Take care, guys.
Yep. He's awesome.
Dave is great, and he's the partner and managing director of One Private Wealth with us every Tuesday on KMOX. And so the most recent update from Washington University here in St. Louis, this was after a report of a person with a weapon on campus earlier. The university went on lockdown as a result. They were encouraging people to stay away from the Danforth campus. This is just from a couple of minutes ago from Washington University. All clear. Police have completed their search of the Danforth campus and did not locate an armed individual. There is no active threat on campus at this time. Normal campus operations may resume. So they searched the campus, did not find anything of concern, and they have given the all clear. So everything back to normal.
Yeah, you wonder if it was some kind of a prank, you know. If so, horrible. Or if there was somebody armed that they escaped, but what would be the, you know. But we're just thankful that there, there was no violence.
Thankful nothing happened, but that is still a story because that's a massive police response that happens. And right. We know that living in the society we live in now, that it would not be unusual for this to happen on a campus, for somebody to go in and start shooting the place up or whatever, because it's happened.
Yeah.
And it happens way more than it should happen. So to get to the point where all these police have to come and respond to it,
right,
really we'll have to get to the bottom of what that was, because either somebody was mistaken or somebody is in serious trouble.
Yeah.
It's one of those two things. So no idea what that was. But the good news is all clear. Police have completed their search of the Danforth campus and the normal operations are resuming at Wash U.
Yeah.
So that's the good news, John.
That is good. And, you know, kudos to KMOX. We had Maria Aquina on the scene.
Yep.
And, you know, we broke the news here last hour and have continued to keep all of you updated as it's played out.
And I know the newsroom continues to work on it and find out just exactly what happened.
Right.
And how this alert went out or why it went out, because that's a thing that we'll have to, it's not one of those things where, hey, the threat is done, everybody just go back to normal now.
No, you got to get to
the find out why that happened.
But we got the hounds out there. We got the news hounds just over the across the glass here, and they're out there sniffing.
Let me tell you something about them news hounds.
Yeah.
They can smell, baby.
Yeah, they can.
They know what they're doing.
They got the nose on the ground, baby.
In the middle between second and third. Runner goes, swing and a miss by Church. Throw down to second. It's going to get all the way out to center field, and that's going to score a run. Weatherholt comes in on the bad throw by the catcher Ramirez.
John Hancock and Chris Ronji today on the Chris and Amy Show. And in case you missed it earlier, they have given the all clear on the Wash U campus. There was a person with a weapon, allegedly, that they put the alert out there for people to shelter in place. But everything is back to normal at Wash U, and it doesn't look like anything terrible has happened there. So just so you know, all clear, and normal operations have resumed there. It is time for us to go to the guest line this morning, and the Cardinals season is coming up, baby. We're about a month away from it, but right now, spring training games are ongoing. The Grapefruit League is happening in Florida. Sam Dykstra, minor league reporter for MLB Pipeline, contributes to MLB Network. Sam is with us on KMOX. We talk a little Cardinals prospects today. How's it going, Sam?
It's good. It's good. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being here. And from everything we hear, everything that we've read, people around baseball, around the country, seem to think the Cardinals have done a pretty good job in the last year or so of building up their prospect base. How good do they look compared to other teams right now in terms of the talent in the system?
Yeah, we are going to come out with our farm system rankings here in a little bit, so nothing is out there official yet. If I were to vote today, given the additions that they've had, given the internal development they've had, it feels like a top five system in baseball, which is where you want to be if you are trading away assets, right? Like Sonny Gray, Wilson Contreras, Brendan Donovan. You want to be acquiring minor league talent that you can build up and see, you know, coming to St. Louis in 2 or 3 years, or in some of these guys' cases very, very quickly. I think they've done well in drafts recently at the top, getting J.J. Weatherholt in 2024, Liam Doyle out of Tennessee last year. There's a real exciting well of talent hiding underneath. I mean, not a lot of these guys are going to break outside of Weatherholt with the major league roster, but there are a lot of reasons to be excited, certainly more reasons to be excited on the farm than many other organizations have right now.
Or then for many years as it relates to the Cardinals. And one of the places where we just have a wealth in the farm system is at the catching position. We've seen Raniel Rodriguez already this spring wallop the ball. Of course, he's a long way away from making the roster, but the Cardinals have a great amount of catching depth, and that's a good piece of capital to have.
Yeah, and it's catching depth in multiple different ways, right? You mentioned Raniel Rodriguez. We've already seen him hit a ball 106.7 miles per hour in Major League spring training. By the way, he's only 19 years old, and he might have the best power in all of the system. So you have that guy who's a bat-first catcher climbing his way towards St. Louis. But above him, you have Jimmy Crooks, who obviously made the majors last year, and Leonardo Bernal, who are both glove-first guys. Bernal was actually a minor league gold glove winner last year. Jimmy Crooks might be even a better defender than him. Both of those guys control the running game. They have different flavors that they're going to pick and choose from. You want multiple bites at the apple, right? You don't want one catcher who you putting all your hopes and dreams on and hoping that guy comes through. With three of these guys potentially taking over behind the plate long term, they give themselves a chance. And, you know, the dream is to have two of these guys flipping off between each other. I still really like Raniel Rodriguez. I'm super excited to see what he can do with that power. Maybe he can be a 30 to 35 homer guy, which is extremely valuable behind the plate.
The guy we talk about a lot here because he is considered to be the top prospect in the Cardinals system is J.J. Weatherholt, who is likely going to make the team out of spring training. And if that's the case, that will hurt whatever the farm system rankings are because he has graduated to the big league. So this is kind of a two-part question. One, what do you think of him specifically as a prospect? And two, what will that do to their rankings when he is no longer in the pipeline anymore?
Well, I'll put it this way first. For your first part of your question, he's our number five overall prospect in all of baseball. Obviously, the hit tool is what excited evaluators mostly coming out of the draft in West Virginia, and the fact that he batted .306 with a .931 OPS last year between AA and AAA, actually started hitting for a little bit more power by the time he reached Memphis, just solidified that he is one of the best hitting prospects in all of baseball. He's somebody you make room for, and that's what they did with the Brendan Donovan trade. I think, you know, things were kind of trending. Maybe he goes over to third base, but he can struggle a little bit on throws. He has the arm strength, but he's a better fit for second. Everybody's believed that. Well, now there's the opening there, and you put him in there. You don't worry about it. I saw an interview with Mason Wynn during yesterday's Cardinals broadcast, where he was saying, you know, those two guys really complement each other really well. Mason Wynn brings the defense. J.J. Weatherholt brings the offense. Now how much can they mix that together and get a little bit more out of offense for Wynn and a little bit more defense for Weatherholt? But those guys playing alongside each other all spring is going to be huge. And then in terms of how it's going to affect the rankings, yeah, it's going to make them drop a little bit. But the whole point of player development is to get major league pieces ready, get them, you know, with exciting tools like Weatherholt has, even if they take a dip. I think that's something that all of Cardinals Nation can celebrate because they got a really, really good prospect to the major leagues when he was ready.
Sam Dykstra is our guest. He's a minor league reporter for MLB Pipeline. Pitching, everybody's looking for pitching, and everybody in baseball is looking for swing and miss stuff, and pitchers get hurt. And we've had some pitchers that have gone through some injuries and missed some time in the minor leagues. I'm thinking about Tink Hentz and Cooper Jerpy. Are those guys potential to see the Cardinal roster at some point in 2026?
Yeah, both of those guys are on the 40-man roster now. Jerpy's coming back from Tommy John surgery that knocked him out for all of 2025. And Tink Hentz, I mean, still has not thrown 100 innings in a season yet. He was dealing with a lat strain to begin last year, then a right shoulder impingement, just really limited. And that's been the story ever since he was taken in the 2020 draft. I think both of those guys could be options this year because, again, they're on the 40-man. I think Hentz is more likely because he's not coming off major surgery in the way that Jerpy is. Jerpy, you want him being built back up. The interesting thing with Hentz is hearing from the St. Louis camp, they might be moving him to relief, not just because they want to preserve his health, but they just want to get him the ball as much as possible. They don't want him just getting one start a week and then having to sit, work on bullpens. Like, work as much in games as he can to get his stuff back because he just hasn't had much game action the last few years. So we'll see what his role ends up being in St. Louis. The stuff still could play as a starter. I mean, that changeup is really special, and he's been in the mid-90s at times with his fastball, but it's all about health for Tink Hentz.
The prospects that the Cardinals received in the Brendan Donovan deal is Gerangelo Sancha, who is throws both with both arms, And he's likely, at least from what we understand, not going to use both arms, or not throw with both arms. He'll have to use both of his arms. But he'll not throw with both hands at the big league level, though they're going to have him, I guess, on the side do some work with the other hand just so he can stay in shape there. How do you feel about him? And then generally, how do you feel about prospects? And there are very, very few of them that are ambidextrous.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a rarity. I can't think of anybody else right now who I would rank as a top 30 prospect for any org who can do this, right? Like, this is just very strange and different, and it's a credit to him. Like, I think he's a natural lefty that throws better from the right side because he's had to work more at it. So the fact that the Mariners were talking about this literally the week of the trade, before the trade went down to send Brandon Donovan to Seattle, that they were going to put the left-hand stuff off to the side and just let him throw righty. And I think that actually adds to his upside because he's done so much to focus on being able to do both, right? Well, now what happens when, at least in games, you're only focused on throwing right-handed, you're focused on getting that stuff as sharp as possible. I think there's another gear to unlock for Gerangelo Sanga, and I'm excited to see what he can do. I mean, it's his second full season. It's a fastball, you know, that gets plus grades, above average slider, decent changeup. If all those pitches take another step there, that's a potential number three or four starter for the Cards.
So perhaps Rawlings won't have to get busy designing a glove that could fit on either hand.
I think they do have those, don't they?
I don't know.
Yeah.
They do. Oh, it's a little awkward, but yeah, it's funny how those work.
I've got oven mitts like that.
Yep.
Okay, so power bats. We've got the young Baez in the system. How do the Cardinals look in terms of sluggers in the minor league system?
Yeah, I mean, Ronnie L. Rodriguez, the catcher I brought up earlier, I think has the best chance for power moving forward. He gets to it really well. I mean, I brought up that double earlier. That's what he does. I mean, he hits the ball hard to the pull side, and as is consistently taught across the game now, that's how you're going to get your power in games. So if he's already doing this at 19 years old, it's so much easier to dream what he can do on the at full maturity when he's in his prime at 26, 27, 28. Joshua Baez is one of the most interesting developmental stories in all of minor league baseball to me. He was somebody who the Cardinals, you know, for years were singing his praises. They really like the upside. You know, he's big at 6'3", but can move decently well. The power, you know, raw power is plus-plus at least. He just struck out a ton, and you kind of had to put him off to the side when you're doing these rankings, because if you're not making contact at single A and high A, you're almost guaranteed not to do that at double A, triple A, and never get a crack at the majors. But to his credit, the Cardinals really went to him and said, hey, man, you have to figure this out. It is your 40-man roster decision year. You're either going to sink or swim. This is what needs to be figured out. And if you look at him hitting side by side, last year it was a lot more streamlined to the ball. It was a less noisy swing, more direct, and the contact rate really took off. I mean, it might be an average hit tool now. And with that, plus the power, it's a really interesting player. You know, he's got a plus arm. He's a natural fit in right field. I know they have Jordan Walker there. He's going to get plenty of leash still. So Joshua Baez can go to AAA this year, maybe tear the cover off the ball and force the issue for St. Louis. But the fact that he's here now as a top 100 prospect, he's number 87 on our list, is a testament to how well he took to development and how much of a plan the Cardinals had for him going into last year.
So we have done here, as you can imagine, a lot of discussion about where the Cardinals' farm system was, where their facilities ranked in terms of what they had, technology they had available for the development of players, and how they had really fallen behind in that area over the last several years. And they kind of let it get away from them and are making more progress to try and correct all of that. As far as you can tell, with what they have done at that level, how much better have they gotten just there, just with the facilities and with, you know, trying to help the development process for players where they had really let everybody else bypass them for so many years?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the stories of the spring down in Jupiter, right, is just the improvement of the facilities at Roger Dean Stadium on the Cardinals side, and getting pitching labs and getting, you know, hitting data that just makes it so much easier to understand what makes all of these prospects tick. What are their best attributes and how can they pull that out of them? It's not a one-size-fits-all approach, nor should it be. Honestly, with today's game, you have so many different body types, so many different ways guys move. Trying to put, like, hey, we want everybody throwing a sinker, that's going to cause some guys to really struggle. And I think just the vocabulary of the Cardinals' development. You know, they brought over Robert Trufoglio last year, Larry Day from the Cleveland Guardians organization. Guardians are exceptional at development and internal development. And you can really see how it's changed and how the ways guys talk. Guys like Joshua Baez taking off, J.J. Weatherholt, you know, maybe even improving on what we saw in West Virginia. Yeah, they had some guys scuffle like Quinn Matthews, who used to be a top 100 prospect, but in many cases it was arrows up in the Cardinals system now, and a lot of that has to do with the guys they brought in. Obviously, Chaim Bloom is now going to be even more focused on player development, and just the access to facilities that they have there at Roger Dean, it's only going to help them, not only now, but years to come.
Yeah, the real emphasis on power pitching arms in these acquisitions that as the Cardinals have dealt off some of their assets. And they brought in these power arms. Looking across Major League Baseball, what's the average hit rate for, you know, say you got a half a dozen pitchers that throw 98, 100 miles an hour? How many of those guys actually make it?
That's a good question. I wish I had an exact number for you off the top of my head. I mean, it's different, right? Like, Major League, I grew up, you know, in the 90s and 2000s, and I remember a fastball that was 95, you would get the flame marker on the screen because everybody thought 95 was throwing hard. Now the major league average is 93, 94. So if guys are throwing 98, it's not the same 98 that it used to be. And just having that pitch isn't enough. I mean, overall, is it going to give you enough, you know, the availability to make the majors if you're throwing 98 over 95? Sure. But you need command. You're not just going to be throwing it all over the shop with 98. There's so much more that you need to do. So somebody like Brandon Clarke, who they brought in from the Red Sox in the Sonny Gray trade, who unfortunately is down now with a shoulder injury. But he was 95, 98 with a pair of fastballs last year, and he's got a really, really good breaker beyond that. So the fastball is not enough anymore. You have to have that plus-plus slider that he has, and I'm really interested to see, once he's healthy, what the Cardinals can do to maybe unlock another step for him.
Every time I see Major League, every time the movie's on and I watch the part where they're in camp, and Rick Vaughn is throwing pitches and he throws the fastball and breaks the sign because he's wild, and they marvel at the fact he threw it 96. Like, how fast was that? 96. And everybody goes, oh my God, 96. And now dudes are throwing 105. It's funny to me to think back on that.
And part of the concern, right, is that we are hitting like what the capabilities are of the human body. We are seeing guys break down more than ever. Like, if you're throwing 100, but it's leading to Tommy John or it's leading to shoulder problems, but it's getting you a shot at the majors, it's so much of what guys have to balance now. Like, I know people are like, oh, why don't you go back to throwing 88, 89 with command? Well, guess what? That's being taken 420 out to left center every time now. Like, batters have improved, right, too. So you need that quality of stuff.
Sam Dykstra, we love the information. Thank you for talking with us today, and we'll do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, guys.
Sam Dykstra, minor league reporter for MLB Pipeline, contributes to MLB Network. So, while this might be a pretty thin season for the Cardinals at the big league level, and you think they might do better than the
projections. I'm excited to see this. Finally, I think the organization is doing it the right way.
Yeah, and I think that what they've done with these prospects, mm-hmm. the fact they've collected quite a few good ones, and at least one of them will graduate this year to the mm-hmm. big leagues, the fact that they have done work there and gotten that talent and are doing better with facilities and training.
All of it.
The future should be a whole lot better for them.
Agreed.
Now it's up to them, once they graduate those guys, to help them out. That means, you know, supplement that talent at the big league level when it's time.
Yeah, I mean
this
you got
isn't the you, time yet, but there will be a time soon.
You've got to have a starting rotation that's upper echelon in order to go deep into the playoffs, and we're not there yet.
It's Chris and Amy show on KMOX. John Hancock is in today. John Hancock is having some difficulty recovering money that he has paid to St. Louis County because he overpaid his property tax.
Paid it twice. And then once it came to my attention that I'd paid it twice, which just another sign that I'm getting old, I picked up the phone, Raj, and I called the St. Louis County Department of Revenue at 314-516-1500 and hit number 3 to talk to a representative. They didn't answer for an hour.
And you can't get a hold of anybody.
I call them again. They didn't answer. They didn't answer. So then I went online and I found an email address, collector@stlouiscounty.mo.gov. And I sent an email to the collector of revenue explaining the fact that I had paid my personal property taxes twice. And to this day, I have not heard a peep from anyone.
And you cannot get through to anybody.
Nobody picks up the phone.
Well, a texter here says you've just made a loan to St. Louis County, so congratulations.
Well, they need to be paying me interest. You know, if I don't pay my taxes on time, I got to pay interest to the government.
Good luck collecting any interest, says this texter. The Missouri Department of Revenue is just as bad, and the counties all follow suit.
I mean, this is ridiculous. You know, I'm paying these people.
We have a voice message from Laura.
Oh. John, it's the same way with Blue Cross Blue Shield. It's the same way with Mercy. It's the same way with BJC. I spent better over 2 hours yesterday going round and round on why my well visit was charged $285 when I should be getting that for free through my Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Well,
you should be getting it for free. This is an outrage.
Every company I've ever seen is really good at collecting money, not as good as paying it out.
That's exactly right.
This texter says, maybe you should just go in person and find somebody to speak to.
Yes, that might be an option. But if nobody's answering the phone, how can I know that anybody will actually be in the office?
Another texter says, just move to Franklin County because their website doesn't allow you to pay twice.
Well, there you go.
Well, you didn't think of that, did you?
Got to put the house on the market.
Got to put the house on the market and move to a completely different county.
Franklin County's got some lovely. Washington, Missouri's
lovely. Well, you better go there. You won't have to overpay.
There you go.
That's what I hear.
I'm in.
When we come back, White House correspondent for The Bulwark, Andrew Egger, St. Louisan Andrew Egger, will join the show. Man, there's a lot happening. State of the Union is tonight. The Olympic hockey team won, and the FBI director was in the locker room for some reason. There's a lot to talk about with Andrew Egger, and that is next on KMOX.